how there was this logical inconsistency between what sort of picture you get if you treat your measurement apparatus as an external intervention versus if you treat it as another dynamical system. So we went through the different possibilities for how you might resolve the quantum measurement problem. And I think, I mean, today I'm going to be talking about the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation, and hopefully I'll also have a little bit of time to talk about psi epistemic approaches to start talking about them. So you'll remember that, you know, of the options for responding to the measurement problem, we talked a little bit about just the purely operational approach, which denies that there's any properties of the systems to talk about, and we discussed some of the problems with that, and we also covered dynamical collapse theories and many worlds. And so we're now on to denying that psi is a complete representation of reality. So that was important in the argument that set up the contradiction, because it was the first axiom in that set of textbook axioms that the quantum state represents reality completely. We needed that to derive the contradictions. So these sorts of approaches, hidden variable models in particular, deny that. And so the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation is an example of a hidden variable model. And so I'm going to tell you about that, and later we'll talk about whether you could have the notion that psi does not completely describe reality without positing that there's hidden variables. Okay, so I'll also remind you that we had this classification of ontological models. I set up that framework for how you might approach realist interpretations. And in that framework, there's a distinction between those that treated the quantum state as a complete description of reality, there's nothing more to say, and those that said, no, it's not a complete description of reality. And among those, there was also a distinction between the ones where it just described some agent's knowledge of reality, and these over here, where the quantum state is part of the description of reality, it's just not everything. So over here, when you vary the quantum state, you're imagining different universes. It's just that the quantum state doesn't tell you everything about the physical state of the universe. Whereas over here, when you're varying the parameters in the quantum state, the physical state of the universe could stay the same, and all that's changing is some agent's beliefs about it. So in the first part of this lecture, we're gonna give an example of such a model. Remember that you know, these guys get lumped together as ones that treat the quantum state as an ontic state. And so that's the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation is an example of this. One caveat, however, is that I really set up these distinctions within the ontological models framework. And there's a sense in which the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation doesn't necessarily fit so naturally into that framework. So you can also think about the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation independently of this classification, just as, you know, yet another approach to making sense of quantum theory. Okay, so how does it work? The idea is that the ontic state of a system, so let's just start simple with a single particle and see what the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation says about it. So the idea is that the ontic state, a complete description of all the physical properties, is given by two things. First, the wave function of the particle, and second, an additional variable referred to as the Bohmian position of the particle. Okay, so the assumption is that, unlike the conventional formalism, particles have a well-defined position, and it's not represented in the usual formalism, but we add it in. And I'm going to denote it by this Greek letter zeta. So, you know, here it is. You know, there's the wave function, there's the particle. The evolution of the Schrodinger, the evolution of the wave function is determined in the usual way. It's just given by Schrodinger's equation, right? So that's exactly as it is in the usual formalism. But there's a second dynamical law, which it specifies how the Bohmian position evolves. And the way it works is this. You take the wave function, so the quantum state in the position representation, you decompose it into in a polar decomposition. So this is the modulus of psi. This is the phase. And you take the phase factor. It's the gradient of the phase that determines the velocity of the Bohmian particle. So you evaluate the gradient of the phase factor, and then you calculate that, and then you evaluate it at the position of the Bohmian particle, divide by the mass. That gives you the velocity of the Bohmian particle. So using these two equations, you can propagate forward in time. So a couple of things to notice. Obviously, the position of the Bohmian particle will come to depend on what the wave function is, because the velocity at any given time depends on the wave function through the guidance equation. But the wave function's evolution does not depend on the position of the Bohmian particle at all. So although it might look a little bit like a field coupled to a particle, which we see elsewhere in physics, it's unlike that insofar as the field does not see the particle. There's no action of the particle on the field. It's only a one-way action. So that's kind of unconventional. And the second thing to notice is that unlike situations elsewhere in physics where you might have a field interacting with a particle, is that here the amplitude of the field is irrelevant to the motion of the particle. The motion of the particle depends only on this phase factor. So if I, in some region of space, change the amplitude of the field and make it larger, the motion of the particle there isn't going to change, because it only depends on the structure of this phase factor. And so for that reason, people call the role of the quantum state in the Bohm interpretation, they describe it as a pilot wave. So the analogy, and this is due to Bohm and Hiley, is that if there's a captain piloting a ship, if you send a radio signal to tell the captain which way to steer, it doesn't matter what the amplitude of that radio signal is, as long as it's strong enough to be received. It's the information in the signal that determines which way the boat steers. And it's the same thing here. It's the information in the structure of this phase factor that determines how the particle moves, not the strength of the wave. Okay. if you take the Schrödinger equation, write the quantum state in the polar decomposition, and then separate out the real part of the equation and the imaginary part of the equation, you get these two equations here. So this is the real part, this is the imaginary part. So this part here looks a lot like an equation from classical physics called the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, where S is Hamilton's principal function, except, and I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, it's not so important for what we're doing here. The key thing you need to know is that it looks like the classical equation, with the exception that V, which is the external potential, is supplemented by this extra term Q that's sort of playing a similar role to V in the equation, where Q is given by this expression here. So remember, R is just the modulus of the wave function, so it's the gradient squared of R over R with this prefactor, and that's called the quantum potential. So you can think of it as an addition to the usual external potential that's determined by the wave function. Right? So if you like, you can think of this as the difference that quantum mechanics makes for this equation is that the potential has been changed to include this term here. And again, note that it doesn't depend on the magnitude of the wave function, because if I multiply R by a scalar, it cancels out in this equation. It depends only on the shape of the wave function. The other equation is just an equation that expresses the conservation of probability. So R was the modulus of the wave function, so this is just psi squared. So that's the probability in a given region. And this is just the probability current, because grad of S was the velocity of the Bohmian particle. R squared is the density. So if I multiply the velocity by the density, I get a current. So this is just the usual equation expressing the conservation of probability. Whatever, the probability will go down if I have a net probability flow out of some region. Yes?
How come you're still calling R probability if you said the amplitude didn't matter?
So can you repeat the last bit?
How come you're still calling R the probability of the wave when you said the particle doesn't matter or doesn't care about the amplitude?
It's true that its velocity at a given time does not depend on what that amplitude is. But the significance of the amplitude, as we'll see, I think, on the next slide, is that it determines the likelihood that the Bohmian position is. So if you say at a given time, what's the chance that the Bohmian position is here? The answer is going to come back, that's given by psi squared or R squared. And so it still has relevance for statistical predictions. So it'll tell me what the likelihood of these different positions are.
But the evolution of the Bohmian position is deterministic.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the initial conditions are going to be such that you don't know the initial Bohmian position, And therefore, even though the Bohmian position evolves deterministically, you're going to continue to have ignorance about where the Bohmian position is at later times. Other questions? OK, so it turns out if you want, you can express the dynamics of the Bohmian position in perhaps a more familiar form, a Newtonian form. So you can work out what the second order time derivative is. And it looks just like, again, like the classical equation, where the classical equation would just be the gradient of the external potential. But you have this addition of the gradient of the quantum potential. Of course, this is evaluated at the position of the Bohmian particle. OK, so there is, however, a difference. Even though I can express it in this form, there's still a significant difference between the nature of the dynamics in de Broglie-Bohm and in Newtonian mechanics, not just that the external potential has been changed to a new potential. And let me put it to you. Can you see some other way in which I shouldn't think of it as like Newtonian mechanics, even though I can write it in this form? So another way of asking the question is, the form I gave it to you before, this one, makes it look very much unlike Newtonian mechanics. So there's, in a sense, there's something that's kind of hidden when I write it in this form. Anyone see what it is? It's about the boundary conditions and what you need to predict future evolution. So in Newtonian mechanics, I'm allowed to independently specify the initial position and the initial velocity. And all the equations of motion determine is the acceleration. Whereas in the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation, once you specify the initial position, the velocity is fixed. That's what the guidance equation does. So you actually don't have freedom to specify both a position and a velocity. So that's the sense in which it's really a first order differential equation that determines the Bohmian position, not a second order one. And that's the sense in which this is rather misleading. So the dynamics are fundamentally first order. And so people say, for example, that this makes the theory more like an Aristotelian theory than a Newtonian theory. So after Newton's theory, we knew that it was accelerations that needed explanation, that if I have no forces acting on a particle, it will continue on with whatever velocity it has. And we don't need to explain how the velocity changes. Whereas in the Aristotelian theory, people thought that it was the velocities of particles that needed to be explained. And where you were in a gravitational field determined your velocity. So it is kind of an Aristotelian theory in that sense. Okay, good. I put it in the slide so that you could have a copy, how to derive that Newtonian form, but I'm not going to go through the derivation. All the slides are available if you want to go through it yourself. Okay, let's get to this business about the distribution of the Bohmian positions. So the idea is this, that if, imagine you know exactly what the quantum state of the particle is, and the question is, what do you know about the Bohmian position? So the assumption of the interpretation is that this rho xi d xi is the probability that the particle is arbitrarily close to xi. So what that means if I define this way, then the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation says that that probability is just given by psi squared. So it's assuming that you start off ignorant of the position and your ignorance is characterized by the modulus squared. But what's interesting about that assumption is that you can prove that under the dynamics of the theory, at all future times, if at the initial time your ignorance of the Bohmian position is given by psi squared, then at all future times it's given by psi squared as well. Okay, so let's take a look at why that is. So there's the velocity field for the Bohmian position. You can calculate the probability current density by just multiplying the velocity field by density. This is the equation for the conservation of probability. And so if you plug in this expression here, plug that in, this is what you get. But the imaginary part of the Schrodinger equation that I showed a few slides back had this form. So if initially r squared and rho are equal, then if I look at the the rate of change of the difference between them. Could they start off having no difference and then evolve to something that had a difference? I just have to subtract these two expressions. That gives me the difference between these two expressions. But I know now that these are the same because I've assumed that rho is equal to r squared. So this difference never changes. They're always going to stay the same if they start the same. Okay. So any questions so far? No, let me continue. So there's an important notion in Bohmian mechanics, which is the notion of an occupied wave. So let me take you through it. Suppose we have a wave function that decomposes into a sum of different terms. And now I'm going to refer to the spatial support of some wave function, so in particular some psi j, as just all the positions where this amplitude is non-zero, right? So if you know, imagine a wave packet, its spatial support is just the region over which that wave function differs appreciably from zero. So if the Bohmian position of the particle, right, this extra degree of freedom we specify in addition to the wave function, is inside the support of the jth term, the jth wave function is decomposition, then I'm just going to say the jth wave is occupied. So this is the terminology in this approach, that we talk about whether a given wave in this decomposition is occupied or not. And if it's not in the spatial support of some particular wave function, then we say that that wave is empty, doesn't contain the Bohmian particle. And now here's the important thing, that if it turns out that only the kth wave of this decomposition, for example, is occupied, if it's the only one, then the guidance equation that determines how the Bohmian particle position changes depends only on the form of that kth wave and doesn't care about the other terms in the decomposition. So let's see how that works. So suppose I just have two terms to make it simple, psi A and psi B. Then when I do the polar decomposition, if I ask about the polar decomposition of the overall wave function, and if I denote the polar decompositions of A and B just with the subscripts A and B, then you can work out what R is in terms of RA, RB, SA, and SB. You can work out what grad S is, and it's this ugly formula here. And the key thing is that if the spatial supports of those two guys are basically non-overlapping, right? So these are the moduli of the two wave functions. So if there's no region of space where they both have appreciable weight, and furthermore, it's the case that wherever RA is non-zero, also the gradient of RB is close to zero. And vice versa, then you can see that this term is going to drop away because RA, RB is close to zero. This term, these terms are going to go away. And what you're going to find is that R and grad S just have these forms here. And so if I ask how is the Bohmian position going to evolve, this is just the guidance equation again. And if the Bohmian position is in the support of psi A, right? So these guys don't overlap, so it has to be in the support of only one of them, not both. If it's in the support of psi A, then only this term, because I'm evaluating this at the Bohmian position, RB at that Bohmian position is going to be basically zero. So it's just going to be this term contributing. The RA squares are going to cancel. I'm going to get grad SA. So it's just being guided by the first wave, the phase of the psi A term. Whereas if the Bohmian position is in the support of psi B alone, then it's the same argument, and it depends just on the grad of SB. So if I have these two waves and they don't overlap in space, then the Bohmian particle evolves as if it's just one term. Doesn't care about the empty wave, the other term of the wave function. So I've told you basically everything you need to know about the basics of the dynamics to start working out some problems. So I'm just going to give you a few examples. So this is a very famous illustration of what the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation predicts is going to happen to the particles in a double slit experiment. So these are the two slits. The distance screen will be over here. And This is from a paper by Dudeney et al. What they've done is they've just taken a number of representative initial positions, and the density of the choices it just respects the psi squared. So I've got a denser set of trajectories where the psi squared is higher. And then they propagate the equations forward. So they assume that the wave function starts out in a coherent superposition of going through the two slits. They propagate the wave function forward. They compute the guidance equation for, say, if I, you know, then the bottom one, if I start the Bowman position here, here's how they calculate it evolving. If the Bowman position starts here, they calculate it evolves. It moves and it, you know, ends up here. So the first thing you notice is that for, you know, early times, where these wave functions are still sort of spreading out from their slits and they haven't overlapped at all, what I just told you would be that, okay, if the Bowman position was over here in the bottom split slit, this part of the wave function is an empty wave. It's not influencing the dynamics of the particle at all. So the particle just sees grad s of its term. And that means that it's just going to have a constant velocity because the phase doesn't have any spatial dependence for this kind of thing. So it's going to evolve just like it would for a wave function that's just dispersing. And that means rectilinear motion. Like, for example, if I just had like a plane wave e to the ixp and I calculated grad s, it's going to tell me the velocity is just proportional to the momentum and it's not going to change. That's the kind of evolution we have here, the kind of evolution we have here. But when these wave functions start overlapping in space, now if the Bohmian position happens to be in a region where those two wave functions overlap, now it's not being guided by a single term anymore. It's going to see that there's, you know, the interference pattern is going to start developing between these two wave packets. So now we're going to have this non-trivial dependence of the phase factor on space, and that's mean its velocity is going to start changing, right? And so that's why it starts wiggling around. And the further I go in time, the larger the region these two wave packets are interfering, and so we find, you know, that the region in which the particle responds gets bigger. And what's interesting is, you know, if I think about how the particle is moving over here, the assumption in the double slit is that the external potential is zero, right? This is just, classically, this would just be free particle motion. You know, the particles would follow straight lines. It's only because the wave function is there and is contributing through the quantum potential, for example, in the Newtonian picture, that this is not rectilinear motion. So in de Broglie-Bohm, even motion of a particle through free space can be non-rectilinear, because of the role of the wave function as a pilot wave changing its velocity. Of course, in the long run, what you see is that the particle trajectories bunch up into an interference pattern. And we knew that did have to happen because of that result that says that if originally the distribution of Bohmian positions goes like psi squared, then finally it has to go like psi squared as well. And this is what psi squared looks like in the far field. It's just going to be the interference pattern. OK, here's a couple of other examples. If I look at what the Bohmian theory says about transmitting a particle through a barrier, a barrier that lets about half the particles through, then this is what the trajectories look like. So in the place where the wave function reflects, I get a bit of interference between the reflecting wave function and the incident wave function. And so I get a little bit of wiggles in the trajectories here. But elsewhere, they're rectilinear. This is what a beam splitter, a 50-50 beam splitter, looks like. The trajectories come in from both sides, and then some trajectories go out, and some trajectories go this way. So is there anything about these kinds of evolutions that stands out? There's one sort of feature of Bohmian trajectories that really is kind of independent of what the scenario is. And I should be more specific about my question. Is there something about these trajectories that you would not expect to see in a classical theory, a Newtonian theory, some characteristic of them? I mean, besides the fact that they're not rectilinear in free space. I'll give you a clue. One way to describe what's happening here is that if you ask which of these Bohmian positions, initial Bohmian positions, corresponded to being transmitted ultimately, and which corresponded to being reflected ultimately, you'll find that is about here. All the ones below here in the bottom part got reflected, and all the ones in the top part got transmitted. It's sort of a bit hard to see, but yeah, it's the leading Bohmian positions, the ones that started out closest, that get transmitted, and the trailing ones that get reflected. And if I go to the beam splitter case, it's not as if any of these Bohmian positions get transmitted through, and none of these get transmitted through. All of these get reflected, and all of these get reflected downwards. So the characteristic that I'm thinking of is the fact that none of these trajectories ever cross. So you know, the reason none of these guys can make it through to the other side is that to do so, they would have to cross some other trajectory. And there's a principle in Bohmian mechanics that says trajectories cannot cross. So why is that? Why can't trajectories cross in Bohmian mechanics? Yeah.
Because all the evolution is results from just a position.
Like, exactly.
Specify the position.
Exactly. Yeah, in Newtonian mechanics, I can have you know, a particle at a given position with two possible velocity vectors, and then it evolves differently, and so I can imagine trajectories crossing. But here, if you tell me the position, the velocity is fixed, and so it goes wherever it goes, and there's no possibility. You know, if I had two trajectories that cross, that would mean at that position, it would have to be consistent with two velocities. So you can actually figure out a lot about you know, what's going to happen according to de Broglie-Bohm interpretation just by using this principle that trajectories don't cross. So these are just a few examples of that. Good. All right, let me tell you a bit about what the theory looks like for multiple particles now, because we just looked at the single particle case. So a full description of the physical state is now given by the wave function on configuration space for the two particles and a Bohmian position for each of the particles. So for instance, if we're talking about, say, a two-dimensional space, just for simplicity, for the diagrams, then each particle, now I have to give its x and its y coordinate. But for the wave function, if I'm talking about two particles living in a two-dimensional space, that's a four-dimensional configuration space. The position of the first particle, I have to give its x and y components, similarly for the second particle. And the wave function lives on that space. So the important thing is that now the wave function doesn't itself live in physical space anymore. It lives on the configuration space. So there was a temptation in these, you know, this single particle case to think about what was going on as there's this wave, like a field, that's pushing the particles around and telling them where to go, and they're both sort of in space-time. But you realize that that picture breaks down here because there's no way you can think of this as just like another field, like an electromagnetic field. An electromagnetic field lives in physical space. This is a much more exotic sort of thing because it lives in configuration space. And so the pilot wave is not a wave in physical space. Okay, so again, you know, what happens? The evolution equation for the wave function is just Schrodinger's equation for these two particles. And now I have guidance equations for each of the Bohmian positions. So the velocity of the first Bohmian particle is just given by the gradient relative to the first coordinate of that phase factor. So remember now, I just do a polar decomposition of the wave function for both coordinates. So it's the gradient with respect to the first position of that phase factor evaluated at the Bohmian positions of the two particles. And for the second Bohmian particle, it's the gradient of the phase factor relative to the second coordinate evaluated at the Bohmian positions. Okay, so let's consider what happens for different kinds of quantum states of a pair of particles. Simplest case is just a product quantum state, no entanglement. So particle one has its wave function, particle two has its wave function. When you work out, you know, what this looks like, each of these, replace the expressions for each of these by their polar decompositions, you notice that the overall phase of the wave function is just the sum of those phase factors. And so the guidance equation for the first Bohmian particle, which is just the gradient relative to the first coordinate, well, the gradient relative to the first coordinate is trivial here, so it depends only on S1, the phase factor of the wave function for the first particle. And similarly, for the second particle, it's going to depend only on the phase factor associated with the wave function of the second particle. And so what that means is that the two particles are going to evolve independently, and they're not going to know or care about the wave function of the other guy. And that's kind of what you might expect, particularly if you imagine that these two particles were very far away in space. You might say, well, yeah, it better be the case that the way this particle evolves is really independent of the wave function of the guy who's far away. But it's not. That intuition is going to fail when we start talking about entangled states. So what happens with an entangled state? Well, first of all, note that if the Bohmian position is confined to one of these waves, by which I mean, suppose the jth wave in this sum is occupied, and all the other terms in that sum are empty. Here I'm just defining what it means for a wave to be occupied or empty in this multi-particle situation. And it's exactly the same definition as before. You just take both Bohmian positions and ask whether, so now I can talk about the support on the configuration space R1, R2 of this wave function. So that's just the region of the configuration space where this product is non-zero. And so if a given Bohmian position lies inside the support of this, then I say that wave is occupied. And if it does not lie inside the support, then I say that wave is empty. And now I'm imagining that, you know, we have a situation where just one of these waves is occupied, let's say the kth one, and the other ones are empty. That case, they evolve independently because, as we saw before, when one wave is occupied and the other waves are empty, the evolution just depends on that one wave and it doesn't care about all the empty waves. So in this case, it would say, the evolution is only going to depend on the kth wave in this decomposition. It's not going to care about the other. And if I look at the kth term, it's a product state. And what we just saw on the previous slide is that in product states, those guys evolve independently. So in that case, the particles evolve independently. But if it happens that more than one wave in this decomposition is occupied, then you find that the particles do not evolve independently. And this is true even if the particles are very far away from each other. And so what you find is that because of this phenomena, you have a failure of Bell's notion of local causality, which we're going to define carefully in a few days. And failure of Lorentz invariance at the ontological level. So we're not going to be able to use this to signal faster than the speed of light. We're not going to be able to turn it into a failure of a Lorentz invariance at the operational level of, you know, measurement outcomes. But the picture of what's going on in reality, according to this model, is going to fail Lorentz invariance at the ontological level. Because it's basically going to say that there's going to be influences faster than the speed of light, and therefore, I have to specify some reference frame in which that's happening simultaneously. So let me give you an example of that, just so that we can sort of pull it all together. So suppose you have the following sort of entangled state. So I have two particles. Let's call it electron 1 and electron 2. And I'm just considering two wave functions for each. So imagine electron 2 is in some, you know, harmonic oscillator potential. This is like the ground state in green, the first excited state in red. And imagine that, you know, maybe what happened was that it was excited, and with some amplitude, it transferred some energy over to electron 1 and went to its ground state. So in that case, electron 1 has more energy. But if it only fell to its first excited state, then electron 1 has less energy, so it's moving off less quickly. So this is the entangled state I'm interested in. It conserves energy, and it just involves these phi wave packets that I've drawn here and these chi wave packets that I've drawn over there. Okay, and I've color-coded them so you see where each is. So now suppose the Bohmian positions of the two particles are here and here. Well, if we were just talking about this particle alone, then, you know, both these waves could be occupied. But we've got this entangled state. And the pair of Bohmian positions, zeta 1, zeta 2, fall in the support of this term, right? Because if I look at the two green curves, it has non-zero weight in both the positions of zeta 1 and zeta 2. So that, it's non-zero here. But this term is an empty wave. Because although zeta 2 falls in the support of this guy, zeta 1 does not fall in the support of that guy. And that's enough to say that, you know, this term is going to be approximately zero when you evaluate it at zeta 1, zeta 2. So this is very much like what we saw in the dynamical collapse theories, where sort of enough to localize, you know, one particle in a big entangled state to make the whole term go to zero. It's similar here, where we're saying, look, it's enough for you know, one term in this entangled state to be an empty wave for that whole term to be empty overall. Okay, so for this particular pair of Bohmian positions, this is the occupied wave, and therefore the dynamics will be determined just by this wave function, and it's a product state, so it means the two particles are evolving independently. Okay, so if I look at the evolution of electron 2, for example, just given by this guidance equation, and it cares only about the phase factor of chi A, and so here I've just drawn what that dynamics might look like, and it turns out that because the phase of that wave function, chi A, is real, it just stays put. It doesn't move at all. It has zero velocity. Here I've just drawn in what the psi squared for particle 2 is. Anyway, so it does nothing. But if I change things, right, so imagine that this has happened for a long time. These particles have moved extremely far away. Now I put a wall here that reflects the first particle back, and I make them overlap again. All of a sudden, the Bohmian position, which is in the support of the green wave packet, now becomes in the support of the red packet as well. So suddenly, both the waves in your wave function are occupied. Neither of them is empty anymore, because now zeta 1, zeta 2 is in the support of the product of these red curves here. So this is now also occupied. So now, suddenly, the phase that's seen by particle 2 depends on both terms. And what you see is it responds. So particle 2, that could be light years away from this wall here, suddenly responds to the fact that these wave functions have overlapped. It has to do that instantaneously, faster than the speed of light. So that's the sense in which you get a failure of local causality in this sort of model. Questions about that? The probability distribution of particle 2, so it's just, you know, the reduced density operator of particle 2. So it's, you know, the sum of the squares of these two wave functions. That's why it looks like it has this double peak, because if I take the sums of the squares of these two guys, it'll be a doubly peak thing. That doesn't change. Even though this particle here over here is seeing some causal influence of that overlap, the probability distribution you would measure on particle 2 hasn't changed at all. So that's the sense in which you're not going to be able to use this to send signals. I can't, whether I put up a mirror or not, particle 1 is not going to change anything about the statistics of what you measure at particle 2. So it continues to be a theory that prohibits superluminal signaling. In that sense, at least, it's consistent with relativity. Okay, so how does this theory reproduce the operational predictions of quantum mechanics? Let's imagine we have a measurement of some Hermitian operator A whose eigenvectors are these phi k. All this means is so the chi here is going to represent the initial wave function of some measurement apparatus. And if it happens that I start the particle I'm measuring off in this kth eigenstate, well, then the measurement apparatus's wave function is going to evolve in a way that registers that it was the kth eigenstate. So these chi k's are just different states of the apparatus that register the different possible outcomes. I think in previous slides, I called these like up and down and things like that. But now they're just chi k. And so if I start out the particle in a superposition of these eigenstates, then I get to one of the entangled states. That's exactly the kind of thing we saw in the quantum measurement problem. If you examine how most apparati work, you know, like if it has a pointer on it, then some very large number of particles are going to go into spatially distinct regions depending on which outcome you've got. So if the pointer is, you know, here or here, then it means, oh yeah, there's going to be extremely little spatial overlap of the wave function corresponding to getting the outcome up and the wave function corresponding to the outcome down. So we're not just talking about orthogonality in Hilbert space here. We're saying the spatial support of those different parts, those different states of the apparatus, are going to be distinct. So that's the Bohmians argue that that's a good assumption for basically all measurement devices. So I can assume that for J and K different, these spatial supports don't overlap. And so therefore, if the jth wave is the one that comes to be occupied, so, you know, whatever the original Bohmian position is here, at the end of the day, you know, these are all non-overlapping, so only one of them can be occupied and the others have to be empty. If it's the jth wave that comes to be occupied, then the future dynamics of the particle just depends on the jth waves, and it's like an effective collapse mechanism. It says, oh yeah, the future dynamics of the particle is going to behave as if the wave function at the end of the day was not this superposition, but rather just the phi j term. So in Bohmian mechanics, unlike the dynamical collapse theories, you don't imagine that there's some physical collapse process that actually changes the wave function. All you have is this effective collapse mechanism that says, look, at a certain point in time, the Bohmian particle doesn't care about the other terms in the wave function. Those empty waves stop influencing its dynamics, so it's as if they're not there. I don't need to literally change the nature of the wave function because those other parts aren't going to influence the particle any longer. And then if you say, well, but if those parts of the wave functions are still there, then couldn't they maybe come back, like in our other example, and the particle would suddenly see that, in fact, the collapse has only been effective. Is there some way to sort of show that the collapse was merely effective as opposed to like a real collapse? And the answer that the Bohmian gives is that it is very hard to reverse a process that involves a macroscopic number of degrees of freedom. Like if I want to recohere, like in the Schrodinger cat experiment, you know, recohere the two terms of that wave function, it requires precise control over, you know, 10 to the 22 particles, and I have to, you know, in principle it's possible to do the unitary, which would take it back, but in practice it's inconceivable. And so the idea is that this effective collapse is really effectively irreversible because we don't have the resources to undo that unitary dynamics. You know, like if I have my pointer in the lab and it goes this way or this way, now every molecule in the air has bounced off it, and then photons have carried away that information, and they've left the room and they've gone off in space at the speed of light. You know, do I set up a mirror around the Earth, bring it all back, recohere it? It's just, in practice, impossible. So the Bohmians want to say, so this effect of a collapse is just as good as a real collapse because you're never going to reverse it. And that's why, you know, when we use the formalism in the lab, we never make an error in assuming that the wave function is collapsed because we never get these recoherence phenomena. All right, so that's basically all I wanted to say about Bohmian mechanics. And now let me just mention a few criticisms that people have of the theory. One is this fact that you know, other theories that we have that are empirically successful tend to obey the action-reaction principle, that if you have one degree of freedom that influences another, then there's also a back action. That fails here because the wave function does not, like, it influences the Bohmian position, but the Bohmian position does not influence the wave function. Another criticism is that the quantum state has played two very distinct roles in this theory. On the one hand, it's a pilot wave. It's a physical thing that determines the dynamics of the Bohmian particles. But on the other hand, psi squared was also specifying the initial probability distribution. And we should think of that initial probability distribution as, you know, what we know about the original Bohmian position. So I would say that's a kind of epistemic role to play. So why is it that one and the same entity in this theory are playing these two very different roles, as an ontic thing that guides particles and as an epistemic thing that specifies what you know initially? So it also turns out that there's lots of alternative ways you can do this kind of interpretive strategy. So position played a special role here. Like particles had definite positions in addition to their wave function. But it turns out you could choose a different variable, like momentum, and say, oh, the particle also has a well-defined momentum in addition to the wave function. No position, but just a well-defined momentum. And various people have argued that that also would be sufficient for getting a nice interpretation. You know, measurement devices go into a superposition of states typically which have no overlap in momentum space either, right? You know, like the color of the light that's going to bounce off of your apparatus is going to be different in the two terms. There's going to be different momenta signatures of those outcomes. So all the things that you needed to get a valid interpretation, people have argued, hold also for other choices of bases. And you can also show that you can change the guidance equation. You can add terms to it that make the evolution different and still maintain the property that we needed, which was that if initially the probability distribution is psi squared, then finally it's psi squared as well. So there are many, many guidance equations that preserve that property as well. So it means that there's a huge underdetermination in the form of the theory, that there's lots of things I can vary about the theory, and it makes exactly the same predictions. Operationally, I don't see the difference. And so that can be a criticism because there's a, you know, some people, myself included, endorse a principle that you should only assume any distinction in your ontological description that doesn't make a difference operationally seems like probably not a physical difference. So Einstein used this principle a lot when he argued, for example, that if you can't tell whether you're in an elevator accelerating through free space or in an elevator at rest in a gravitational field, and no experiment you can do can tell the difference, then assume that it's actually you're in the same physical scenario, that there's no difference in the physical explanation of those experiments. So here you have two scenarios that are totally indistinguishable experimentally, but there would be big differences in how you understand them ontologically. You've got this failure of Lorentz invariance at the ontological level, despite seeing the invariance at the operational level. That has been a complaint, although others have argued that maybe Bell's theorem shows that any time you want an ontological picture of what's going on, perhaps you'll have to see such a failure of Lorentz invariance. And then we're going to talk a bit more later about contextuality and non-locality, and I'll come back to this point later, which is just that there's some theorems, some no-go theorems, that prove that you have to have a failure of Bell's notion of local causality. Under certain assumptions, you have to have something called contextuality. But the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation has contextuality and non-locality in situations where it is not required to have it to save itself from contradiction. So it has a lot more of these bizarre phenomena than it strictly needs to have to save itself from contradiction. And then one final criticism that people have made is that those empty waves, although they may not be effective in practice for the evolution of the Bohmian position, they're still there. And so if you ask, well, you know, what is the picture about what's real concerning the wave function? It's just like in Everett. I have this wave function. It branches. All of those branches are still real. So it has this sort of set of parallel universes in the sense that, you know, there's a branch of the wave function where the outcomes of those measurements came out in every possible sequence. I did N measurements in a Stern-Gerlach setting, and in you know, say the Bohmian position ended up in the branch that got sequence 0111100000. Nonetheless, the universal wave function has a term with every other sequence of possible outcomes. They're empty waves, but they still exist. They're there in the universal wave function. They're part of the ontology of this theory. So many Everettians say, look, the Bohmians have just as the word I'm looking for. Exorbitant or something like that, like just as much ontology as we are criticized to have. Like many people complain about Everett on the grounds that it has this universal wave function. They'll say, well, the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation has all of that plus this extra stuff, the Bohmian positions. Now the Bohmians will reply, well, but those extra Bohmian positions are exactly what solves all the problems of the Everett interpretation. Like the problem of saying, what does probability mean? In this approach, you say, well, it's the probability that the Bohmian position is in that branch of the wave function. Everettians might say, well, you know, we don't need that. We can solve the problem of probabilities without Bohmian positions. An interesting final point that can be made here is that there are ideas for modifications of quantum mechanics that are inspired by the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation. So Antony Valentini, who's actually visiting, I think, starting Monday, and will be giving lots of talks next week, is someone who's proposed that we take the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation and we allow the initial distribution of Bohmian positions to be different from psi squared. So he solves this problem of the two roles of the quantum state by saying, no, the quantum state does not play this epistemic role. The original distribution is something else. And what he shows is that for a lot of cases where your evolution is chaotic, so most dynamics in nature is ultimately not integrable. So he says, if you have that, then what you'll find is that on a coarse grain scale, the distribution of Bohmian positions will tend to evolve towards resembling psi squared on a coarse grain scale. So you didn't need to assume it at the initial time. You'll get there eventually. So this is like a simulation from one of his papers where you start off with, how does this work? I think, yeah, this is the wave function. It's evolving. This is the original distribution of Bohmian positions he assumed. And over time, it evolves to start to resemble exactly the structure of the wave function on a coarse grain scale. So from this perspective, you solve this problem. And also, you have a sort of an answer, which is that this view actually makes different predictions from quantum theory. So Valentini calls this quantum equilibrium. After enough time has passed, the distribution of Bohmian positions tends to resemble what you'd expect here. But if you manage to catch a system before it's equilibrated, you'll see different predictions from what quantum mechanics makes. And he's probably going to talk next week about some of the circumstances in which you might hope to see quantum non-equilibrium. And so there you could say, well, if that's your view of what's going on in quantum mechanics, then how could it possibly be just Everett in denial, given that it's going to make different predictions from what Everett would predict? But note also that one of the consequences of this approach is that when you are not in quantum equilibrium, when you're at an earlier stage, not only do you fail Lorentz invariance, but you actually can use these quantum non-equilibrium states to signal faster than the speed of light. So relativity just completely breaks down. It ends up being a wrong picture of the universe. So the claim, if this approach is true, is that relativity theory is strictly wrong, and there is a preferred rest frame. And if we can find this quantum non-equilibrium matter, then we could probe what that rest frame is. OK, so that's all I wanted to say about de Broglie-Bohm, and I'd hoped that I'd finish earlier so we could talk about a couple other things, but maybe I'll leave it to you. Should I spend 5 minutes starting a new topic, or should we just say this is the one rare lecture that ends early and talk about this? We could just chat about this interpretation if you want.
Yeah, I have questions that'll fill 5 minutes.
Great. All right, let's do that.
So at one point when you're talking about the wave functions that represent the a measurement apparatus for particular outcomes. And you mentioned that an Everettian or a Bohmian would say something like the spatial overlap, the spatial support of wave functions for different outcomes should, in principle, not overlap because most apparatuses have this thing where one outcome is spatially separated.
Yep.
And you said it in such a way that it was it should be a point of contention, but it's not. And I can't even imagine. Can't think of an example wherein that idea might not hold. Like, if fundamentally, like you're describing all of your observations in terms of positions of things and stuff, then I don't really see how you have distinct quote unquote outcomes that aren't spatially separated. You know what I mean?
Well, I guess the maybe I was wrong to suggest that this is a point of contention. I mean, I think it has been discussed, but.
The
Bohmians seem to be on pretty solid ground, because suppose I said, well, look, I'm going to try to challenge the Bohmians this way. I'm going to say, I'm going to try my best to think of an apparatus which manages to encode its outcome in a way that does not lead to wave functions that are spatially non-overlapping.
Right.
So I'm going to try my best to build an apparatus where I get two outcomes and they're spatially overlapping. Like maybe the two outcomes will be encoded in a particle being shot off in a plane wave with different momenta. But those two plane waves overlap in space, right? So like, this is what I'm going to attempt to do. But if your apparatus still manages to encode the outcome in macroscopic degrees of freedom, then inevitably there's a kind of decoherence. Like once you've got something encoded in so many degrees of freedom, you tend not to be able to isolate it from its environment. So the environment starts carrying away information. And the sort of generic types of system-environment interactions will carry away information about positions typically. So whatever you've tried to do, typically down the road, which term you ended up in the wave function is going to be encoded in the positions of something. And that's all they need. so I think it is a pretty safe reply. I mean, you might ask, well, is it really true that no matter which preferred basis I chose, like there was this variability, maybe don't choose position, choose something else. Could it be that you could rule out certain bases on the grounds that they wouldn't become disjoint by virtue of environmental decoherence? Maybe. Yeah.
I have another question too. So when you're going through the whole bit before, you talked about the Valentini's work.
Yeah.
It seems like all of the probabilistic aspects, the epistemic aspects,
yeah,
are just propagated from initial conditions. Right? The evolutionist, if you have,
yes,
some initial uncertainty about the,
yes,
position of the Bohmian position, then that gets preserved as you go on. You mentioned that there's other guidance equations that lead to the same preservation.
Yep.
But then it just feels like, I mean, before you talked about the Valentini stuff, then it just feels like there's no specification of where the initial uncertainty in the position, the Bohmian position comes from. Because then you have that, like, it seems like your state, like, you can keep propagating backwards and just assume that your initial conditions now are just the result of some evolution, previous evolution. I feel like you can just keep going back and still have no way of specifying what's the initial distribution of uncertainty that would lead to something over time. And I mean, there's various ways in which you can effectively introduce that, but it feels like that's a missing detail. Like,
yeah, so...
How do you know how to start your evolution?
Like, right.
How do you ever know?
I suspect that many proponents of Bohmian mechanics in its standard forms, and not Valentini's,
yeah,
difference, take a different attitude towards that initial probability distribution than I'm inclined to take. So I like a Bayesian interpretation of probability, so I think this indicates something epistemic.
Yeah.
But for many physicists, a probability distribution doesn't necessarily represent ignorance. So I would suspect that they might say something like, you know, propagate that back to the beginning of the universe, for example. So we interpret it this way, that, you know, the universe's initial conditions were sampled at random from a psi-squared distribution, and then the universe evolved from there. So all the probabilities ultimately trace back to that initial sampling. And it's, yes, we're also happen to be ignorant of what it was, necessarily. I mean, this even presumes that we would have total knowledge of the universal wave function, which we don't. But even if we had total knowledge of the universal wave function, according to this approach, we would be ignorant of that original Bohmian position because it was sampled at random. So to some extent, I think the answer to your question is that they would really believe it sort of goes back to the initial conditions of the universe. That's where ultimately randomness comes from.
Related to that, if,
yeah,
you take the other point of view,
yeah,
where the probability comes from an epistemic consideration, like,
yeah,
it comes from ignorance, then doesn't this, so through the Schrodinger equation, the R squared couples to your pilot wave, and then it seems like my ignorance of the state of affairs has a causal influence on something ontic.
Well, I see what you're saying. You're saying if you took this the wave function to be fundamentally an epistemic thing, a description of my knowledge, and you said that's its true nature, then you might say, if you try to tell me that it also has this pilot wave aspect, then you're saying that what I believe is influencing particles out there. And I think the Bohmian is going to say, no, its true nature is as something physical. And in fact, I think they have an argument for why it has nothing to do with us. Like the idea that the initial state of the universe is sampled at random from this, I think what they want to say is something more like, there are typical configurations and atypical configurations, and as long as the universe is sampled in one of the typical configurations, everything is fine. So I think they really want to try to argue that the quantum state doesn't really have an epistemic role. Now, I'm kind of personally with Valentini on this, that I don't think they've been successful in those arguments, but I think you should see for yourself. So I'm thinking of work by Goldstein and Zangi and Durr, where it's about the typicality arguments for making sense of the initial distribution in Bohmian mechanics. But you're absolutely right. Nobody out there is claiming that, you know, my knowledge is influencing particles in the real world. They need a different kind of answer, which says that the wave function really is something real. I hate saying that. Really is real. Sorry.
Has anybody tried coming up with a way of interpreting QFTs under some kind of interpretation like this?
Yeah, so I didn't go into that, but there have definitely been papers on how would you do a Bohmian interpretation of quantum electrodynamics, for example?
A Lorentzian QFD.
A what?
A Lorentzian QFD.
Lorentzian, like satisfying a Lorentz symmetry.
Like
and what you find is that, like in this example, that you're going to preserve the Lorentz invariance at the operational level, so all your measurement outcomes and everything are going to look Lorentz invariant. But your model of what's going on at the ontological level is going to have to fail to satisfy that Lorentz invariance.
Does the ontology of it look as disgusting as I assume it would? Because it sounds like an awful, awful thing to try to do. It's hard to imagine how this would work out nicely.
So what do you have in mind when you think it's going to be ugly?
The fact that this fails Lorentz invariance, the way you presented it here, so badly, so blatantly. I find it hard to imagine how you would manage to do something like this for Lorentz invariant QFD and have the outcome be anything other than aesthetically horrendous. It seems like there's a massive tension in it.
I can even if I have a Lorentz invariant theory, I can, if I like, describe it as a kind of time evolution. Like, you know, I choose a foliation, describe the evolution of the field relative to that foliation, and that's effectively, you know, if you take that point of view, then you know you have that foliation, which is now going to define a frame relative to which you're going to have these instantaneous superluminal actions, and so it's not such a huge departure from how we would normally formulate the theory, but it sort of it hides all its Lorentz non invariance so that you can't see it at the operational level. That's the idea. I mean, there's also some interesting discussions about what you should take the preferred variables to be, the ones that are like the Bohmian position here. So in electrodynamics, for example, if I have free fields, I could take the electric field or the magnetic field or any linear combination as my preferred degree of freedom. And because the Hamiltonian is really symmetric under those sorts of transformations, none of them really sort of stands out as the right choice. You know, position seems like a pretty natural one here, simply because, you know, usually we think of, you know, the external potential as involving interactions which have a spatial dependence in them. So there is something kind of more natural about spatial, about position than momentum in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. But you have a greater underdetermination problem when you get to electrodynamics. And furthermore, there's even more choices in your fundamental degrees of freedom. So let me take a step back and say spin. Let's say we just asked about spin degrees of freedom. So in fact, there are multiple proposals for how to take account of spin in the de Broglie-Bohm. So in one proposal, you say, yes, there's a configuration degree of freedom associated to this spin, and it's like a vector in space, for example. And there's, you know, a guidance equation for it, and you know the wave function pilots it, and it changes. And so spin is its own thing. But Bell and others showed that actually you could dispense with that extra degree of freedom and say everything we see operationally to do with spin can be entirely accounted for just by assuming that there's positions of these particles. We don't need any extra ontology besides the wave function, which now has its spatial and its spin degrees of freedom. But you know, the extra stuff is just going to be positions. And so like in a Stern-Gerlach experiment, you imagine a spinning particle comes along, and you can work out in Bell's approach that whether you find it spin up or spin down depends only on its initial position entering into the Stern-Gerlach apparatus. And I didn't need that extra degree of freedom. And it turns out that two postdocs who were at Perimeter about 10, 15 years ago showed that you can do the same thing in electrodynamics. You can incorporate both particles and fields in your ontology if you want. Or you can actually leave the charges out of it completely. And you can say, you know what, we only have these, in addition to the wave function, we just have field degrees of freedom. And that's sufficient to describe everything. And that kind of makes sense if you think about Gauss's law that, you know, once you tell me a field configuration, you can sort of infer where the charges must be. So you don't need the charges there as well. Anyways, but so if you're interested, you know, you can find many papers on these sorts of topics. They, I would say, might relieve your anxiety about whether this can be applied to field theories. but they might increase your anxiety about the degree of underdetermination that exists in this sort of interpretive approach. Yeah?
The first criticism, the failure of this action-reaction principle.
Yeah.
Is this really something that people are concerned about? Because I could just imagine modifying the way that, like, the Schrodinger equation or the guidance equation in such a way that the back reaction from the home position on the wave function is just negligible, right? Like, it seems like it could very well be the case, right?
Mm.
Like, it could, like, in the same way that my back reaction on the Earth is negligible. Like,
yeah.
You know, it's still there, but it's just not a meaningful part of the theory, right? It's in the domain in which you're thinking about the problem, right? Like, see what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
It seems like it'd be an obvious thing to fix if it's really a point of criticism.
So,
we know how to do it in detail, but it seems reasonable.
I think proponents of this approach don't really see it as a criticism. They might say something like, well, you know, just because something was an aspect of all of our previous best theories doesn't mean it's going to be part of the next theory, right? So they would say, we don't care. But somebody who did care about the action-reaction principle because they thought it was sort of a deep principle and it shouldn't be violated might respond to what you said by saying, well, let's be a bit more careful and try to quantify the action-reaction principle. And maybe we can show that, in fact, it's not just if there's an action, there must exist a reaction. But furthermore, there must exist a reaction whose strength is comparable to the action itself. I suspect that you could prove something like that in Newtonian mechanics and in other theories, that there's going to be a kind of commensurateness between the action and the reaction.
Right.
And therefore, they would say your proposed solution will violate that souped-up version of the
right.
principle. Maybe we should end here. Okay. I think I'm doing Monday, but I'm not sure. But yeah, probably you'll see me Monday.